Kelvin, I think that you mentioned also in your priorities a modified forensic, either the concept of a forensic or a modified forensic. And then I think you also indicated that that was in a report, the global capital markets and the global economy, a vision for the CEOs of the international audit networks, which was issued in November of 2006 for consideration. You want to spend a minute or two and review some of your thoughts on that as well?
Sure. I'd mentioned some type of a modified forensic audit requirement where in areas where there's been known fraud, perhaps the PCAOB and the other auditing agencies should impose some type of forensic audit requirement where it requires to go beyond the routine financial statement audit and require more in-depth analysis of the transactions. One of the things I suggested, and it's based upon my background as a compliance auditor, is when I do audits, and I go and do the audits, and I notice that some of the examiners from other states, they may want to focus on, looking at a set 10% of the transactions, 10% of the, customer files, and they think they can then take that and project it onto the, 100% of what the transactions would be. But I think that's that low threshold is extremely too low, and I think we should require the audit firms to look at more than, say, 5 or 10% of the transactions and then project it onto the overall population. If you require the audit firm to look at more, higher percentage of the population, you may have a better chance of detecting any irregularities.
Thank you, Steve. I got to run for an airport here before long, but I did want to make a couple comments. I think Tony is absolutely correct in that we spend all week long auditing the numbers, but only look at disclosures at 4:30 in the afternoon. That has certainly typically been my experience, and I think he raises a very good point. The professional standards do require the auditors to go get evidence, substantial evidence for the footnotes, but they tend to do it at the last moment, ask a client to give them some schedule that'll tie out to the footnote, and boom, and they're done. I actually, probably some more guidance would be helpful, but more than anything would be some good strict enforcement. If out of your inspections and out of your enforcement program you took a hard look at these and actually took enforcement actions against some firms that had failed to gather the evidence they needed for the footnotes, I think that would be excellent. Now I know you're hamstrung now because of the private nature of your enforcement actions, and unfortunately Stanley had, and those of us at the SEC had, a much more public enforcement regime. We made 102Es a public process during Dan's stint as general counsel, much to his credit. And I honestly think you absolutely need to go get legislation and get a change here to be able to make your enforcement actions public. Keeping them private has proven just to engender the accounting firms to fight you all the way through. So I think, one, that dramatically needs to be changed, and as an investor, I'd like to see that so we get some timely enforcement. But I think if you took enforcement actions against a couple firms on disclosures, and now your inspection process came out with, I think it's a 40-20 report that said, here in general is some shortcomings that we've seen from the inspections, I think the combination of those things would be very helpful. As far as expanding the auditor's role, I have been a fan of having the auditor go ahead and give a report on MD&As. Quite some time ago, there was a standard that the profession floated. Actually, I think about the same time Dan was general counsel as well. And nothing has happened with that. I think having an auditor report, providing some assurance around what's in that MD&A report, and the completeness of that report to us about the trends and what's going on with operations would be of tremendous help. On the forensic angle, I do sit and chair the audit committee of a public entity where we actually do engage the auditor and pay him extra to have a forensic accountant come in each year and do work for us. Now, we design that each year around the particulars, and I sit down with that person and say, here's what I want you to do for us. But we do have a forensic piece of it, and I think it's very good in that it keeps people on their toes, and it's been good in framing the mindset of the auditors, the regular auditors, if you will. So I think, as the O'Malley panel recommended, building some type of that forensic expertise and notion into the regular audit would be very beneficial. I've done that, and I found it to be very helpful and very good. And, in fact, I found that it has, in some instances, done a very good job then of informing the audit staff of some things that they hadn't focused on subsequently did. So I'd be a big supporter of doing that.
Joe, before we go to you, I don't know, Meredith, I know you got to take off for a plane shortly as well. Do you have any, we can go to Joe, but if you have any comments that you'd like to make before you clear out of here,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for having to leave early. I have an engagement with several of those 463,000 members tomorrow morning in Western Colorado. However, I'm a strong supporter of the forensic approach. I think it's a different mindset. I think it does a wonderful job of keeping the entity on its toes. Just knowing that a different look will be taken on a regular basis. Going back to my rotation pitch, I would suggest that not be the same forensic accounting firm each year, and I see them probably, working, whether they work separate and then report directly to the company, the audit committee, or if they're an adjunct to the regular audit effort. Just to have that presence, I think, is the most important thing. Thank you.
Well, since we've heard it before, I'd like to get the response from the judge, Kelvin, and you in terms of the cost. And how we deal with that. Judge, we've raised it with you, and I'd like to get all three of you to respond to that.
This has come up in connection with Foreign Corrupt Practices Act matters. And my discussion with my clients, other than the accounting firm, is since... I think they all have been faced with FCPA issues. They think it's terrific. They think it's much cheaper than having to go through a Siemens, $1 billion investigation. And so the cost hasn't really been an issue there. Remember, you're going to have to do a lot of risk assessment as to how you want to do it and what you're going to be looking for. You're not going to go in and do a general forensic so it shouldn't be that much, and I have not yet seen a pushback on the cost. It probably will be there, but we'll have to wait and see.
Meredith?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Meredith Williams. I totally agree with Judge Forkin. I believe that on a risk-reward basis, you can't afford to go in the other direction. Again, I think it would require a regular assessment of where you want to focus those resources in any given time frame, and I think that would change over time as the risks change. Small price to pay.
Well, I guess you're out of here, too. Why don't we go around this way?
Just real quickly, Steve, because I have done this, and we've made it part of our audit process. The cost was fairly negligible in comparison to the overall audit fee. It was not that significant to have it done. The benefits in terms of what they learned and how that informed the audit and improved the audit process in and of itself, including some risk and some things we needed to change, was very helpful to the audit team as well as to the audit committee and the board. So that was very helpful. And when you look at the benefit, though, you also have to measure what happens in the market when you find these things. And if we could have avoided even a small fraction of these losses and headed off some of this stuff, the benefit would have been tremendous. And the one thing that I've seen when you did these forensic audits, we've all talked about how is it that the auditors never saw, or management never saw, or the board never set up and said anything about these subprime loans and the things that other people were engaging, the repo 105 transactions. The one thing I found is that forensic auditor is the one person that walks in the room and says, time out. What are people thinking? That's what that, my experience has been, that's what that forensic person does. And the benefit of having had, if we'd had some people in these rooms at a Countrywide, you know, at a Citigroup, at an AIG, standing in there and saying, time out, what are you guys thinking about? The benefit would have been immense to us, and the cost would have been a drop in the bucket. And, you know, like I said, we do it.
Joe, and then we'll just go right the way around.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go, Steve. And I think what I heard, and I thought it was very good, from Bob was talking about, if I heard him right, additional auditor involvement with the MD&A, maybe the CD&A, FX hotline, ERM system. I agree they're all important, and I think auditor attestation on those would be useful. And then I heard the judge talk about the forensic audit, and I think that would be extremely useful. But as I was sitting here, the issue that came to my mind is exactly the issue that you raised, and that is, to the extent the auditor is involved in these spaces, would the benefits exceed the costs? And so I want to pose a question to Gus and to Ann, and now you know they're Gus is with obviously a very large mutual fund complex. Ann is a very large public pension fund. To a lesser extent, a little bit different, Pete and Norman, representing in my mind a hedge fund and a private equity group. And because if you propose this, here's what's going to happen. Management is going to say, no, we don't want to pay the extra fees. But it's not their money. It's really, in Gus's case, my money, right, in my 403B and 401K, but he has to make the decision. I can't make the decision. There's too many of me's. So how much value does this have for investors, and what is, you know, what are you guys willing to pay for it? Because that's really the decision, not what management says. That's really kind of irrelevant.
Pete Knocklake. Actually, I think this dialogue has been great. And I'd expand it probably well beyond just the forensic, although I've got a very healthy respect for what forensic accounting can do. But, you know, look at what we do when we buy a company. And, yeah, you know, our portfolio, we've got about 500 entities across 67 different funds. And we rely on our investment professionals basically to go in and identify what the risks are and what we want to kind of peel back layers of the onion on every single company we look at. Now, we don't get forever to do that. Typically, we get a matter of weeks if we're in an auction or a bidding process. But the kind of things that we bring in addition to the forensic side, if we have any concerns, are going to be valuation experts, actuarial experts, engineering, you know, could be whether it's oil reserves or it's long-term construction contracts or complex manufacturing contracts. Getting that kind of expertise involved from our standpoint to diligence a company we're looking at buying is almost the same kind of thing that auditors need to be doing to say, or the, you know, the financial statements that all of us are relying on to make investment decisions reliable. The challenge is, and I think most of the accounting firms have maintained at one point or another resources in all of those areas. I think where most of them are today, you know, forensic accounting and valuation is almost standard table stakes that you've got to have those experts and probably actuarial. But the issue is, you know, getting the clients to pay for it. That's, you know, again, one of our big challenges. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about that, but, you know, at the end of the day, the clients pay for the audits, and how do we make sure that that becomes part of the, if it's part of the audit standard where every accounting firm has to do it, so there's no optionality if I want to go look at, well, geez, firm X is going to voiced all these experts on me, but firm Y is going to say I don't need to use them, or they're not going to need to use them in the audit. I think, we, again, something that this group could possibly help with, the PCOB could help with, is taking that optionality out of the audit. Second is, how do you maintain the capability? And that's more of a business issue, because you really need world-class people facing off. You know, you don't want to have, you know, a young capital markets guy at one of the accounting firms going up against Fab, whatever his name is, at Goldman Sachs, you know, without the same level of both talent, energy, experience, et cetera, and how can they maintain that inside the Big Four if they're just audit support? So, you know, allowing them to actually be in the business commercially helps them to maintain the expertise. And then last but not least, we talked a lot about disclosures for companies and financial statements, but maybe there should be a little bit of disclosure around the experts that were used in an audit, so that we as investors or users of the financial statement, if we're looking at an insurance company and there's no actuaries involved, or an oil company and there's no engineers involved that understand oil reserves, you might scratch your head a little bit. So just some thoughts.
Gus?
Thank you. This is Gus Sauter. Joe asked the question, you know, what do we think as investors of other people's money about the costs of requiring forensic accounting? And number one, I'm going to say I'm probably a little bit of odds with the rest of the people around the table, perhaps because, quite honestly, I don't know what the cost of forensic accounting would be. Lynn said that it's really not much, and I think Judge Sporkin pointed out that you wouldn't just blindly do it across the board, that you would measure risks and then apply it accordingly. Costs do matter at the end of the day, and it's not just the level of the costs, but it's the total value over time of those costs as well. So if we're talking about, you know, really what could be hundreds of millions of dollars of additional costs of accounting, that could be billions of dollars worth of value when you assign a PE ratio to it. Nevertheless, it's pointed out that if you catch one bad actor, that could pay for that. So on the one hand, I ask the question, does it need to be an independent forensic accounting, or should this be something that we require inside of a normal audit? That audit firms perhaps should have this capability themselves. It's not forensic accountants aren't super accountants. You know, why wouldn't this be something that the accounting firm could do? So I come at this from two different directions, saying there certainly can be some benefit to it, particularly when you catch the bad actor. But I am concerned about costs, and I do raise the question about what the form should be. Is it truly an independent forensic accountant? Could it be the same? Should it be required of auditors in general?
Sure.
Some of the firms, some of the Big Four, and they probably all do, but I know specifically on at least some of them, they actually have very complex algorithms as they plan the engagement. And the algorithms measure financial characteristics, governance characteristics, a whole bunch of other things that you could probably think through. And they've essentially back-tested these algorithms against restatements. And then they assign loadings out of a regression on the factors, and they come up with a risk score. Okay, so it's essentially a risk model. And if the risk score is above a certain cut, this particular firm requires involvement by forensic auditors. But that's a voluntary decision. Would it make sense from an investor perspective, at least, you know, from your point of view, maybe not to go to a blanket forensic requirement, but to say if risk is assessed at high, and you got to be careful with language, but if risk is assessed as high, then that's a requirement on the audit. And then the cost is more targeted to where the risk is higher.
Let me mention what my model is, in which we're testing. And my model is every firm has a forensic component. The problem is, when I went in there, is I found out that forensic component was doing work with third-party companies, not with their own clients. So the answer is yes, you use your own, the accounting firm, under my model, would use its own forensics, so that there's a synergy and everything else there. You know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that if you're doing business in China, or in some other foreign company, country where you have a high risk of a bribery, I mean, that's right away tells you that you gotta do something. Any company that's doing business in those countries that's doing so like a horse with blinders and not worrying about this, you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, how can they just walk in and say, well, we're not going to consider any of this? And so it's to me it became obvious, this kind of thing, as to how you have to put these things two together. I mean, there's no genius here. You put them together because you see that you know that all you do is talk to an accountant. He's talking to you about the materiality. He doesn't want to look at that thing. It's not material. You talk to your forensic, and he's interested in the low hanging fruit. He's interested in looking at that. So that's it. No, but you should use the same accounting firm to cut down on costs. There's no reason why it has to be an independent. I think it would be too disruptive, and there would be too many. Already there's some disagreements we're finding in connection with my analysis of the pilot program that we're using. There is some. Contention there, but that can be worked out.
Sir. It's Norman Harrison. First on the resource question, I think the judge is absolutely right, and Joe, in my experience, the Big Four firms certainly have a talented pool of auditors and accountants with forensic backgrounds. I think most of them happen to reside in the advisory practice, and that's, you know, they're, as the judge said, providing those services, but to perhaps non-audit clients, but I think the resources are certainly there. It'll be a question of allocation and how to build that into the model. With regard to your question, Joe, about, you know, how much, what's the value or how much would investors be willing to pay, I'm going to answer it like a lawyer, not like an investor. My answer is the lawyer's typical answer, and that is it depends. It depends on what we're getting. What incremental comfort or assurance we're getting from the additional effort, I think. And Tony, in his opening comments, made reference to the expansion of scope of areas or resources in an audit process in an effort to achieve some validation of things. And I think, you know, when you start down the path toward validation or verification, I've often wondered if we were going to go back to square one and design the auditing process and profession all over again, would we find, or have we gotten to a point where there is, in essence, a sort of a fundamental mismatch between what auditors are selling and what issuers want to buy? Is it something more like assurance? And if so, then what does that tell you about the business model and about pricing and about risk and about liability and all of these issues? I mean, there are a lot of very big macro issues here, I think, that your subject touches upon. In terms of what it is that we hope and expect, and I think sometimes perhaps wrongly assume that the audit process is delivering to us, but if we could really get it, you know, it would be something presumably that you would be willing to pay for.
Brandon Becker, just a couple brief observations. Just a reminder that we had a conversation about a fraud center or some lessons learned assessment earlier today, and it would seem to me that if you had a more robust one, it could help supplement and assist the risk assessment process of what you did with your forensic audits, and you could help bring a better identification of where you wanted to allocate those resources. With respect to the cost issue, I concur with the it depends. If it's just another checklist of items that are an added expense across the board, I don't think it provides much value added. If it's the kind of sensitive assessment of risk on a targeted basis, and you can assure me that Judge Sporkin is doing that on each menu item, then I think it's going to provide value added. But that would be the trade-off, is whether it became a more mechanical process rather than a well-textured assessment of individual risks. And then third, I think it was Peter who mentioned earlier, one of the things that I'm most concerned about, apart from forensics, is whether we maintain the expertise and talent within the audit function. So for me, independence and other issues and what migrates into advisory are interesting questions, and we use various prophylactics and rules to do that.
But what I worry about structurally is whether we siphon off all the key talent into those functions, and how do we maintain the talent in the audit function, in the valuation process. Because while I don't in any way want to denigrate the importance of the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act and maintaining the integrity of our payment structure, valuation issues, getting a good assessment of the quality of earnings, is critically important going forward in trying to assess the financial reports of companies. And even more so, I would say, in some instances, without trying to sound sacrilegious, than running to ground their particular payments in a jurisdiction, which we should do, but knowing how they're assessing those risks and having the right talent doing that strikes me as critical to this exercise.
In the information that we circulated, we indicated that we wanted everybody to have the opportunity to express their top priority before we left. We're closing in on 5 o'clock. We've got 20 minutes more. I do want to finish on time. There are three areas that were brought up that I don't think have been covered, and then we'll just close it up with anybody's closing remarks. Brandon Becker and Bob, you mentioned executive compensation in the context of audits. Investor education, the expectations gap. Kelvin, you mentioned that, and Bonnie Hill, you mentioned it, and Meredith is gone, so we'll save some time there. And on inspections, Barbara has gone too, but Bonnie Hill, you mentioned that, and Mike also is gone. So I think we're going to be in pretty good shape getting out of here at the allotted time, and we would have in any event. But on executive compensation, Bob or Brandon, you both mentioned that, and if you want to make some comments on it, we'd appreciate it.
Well, briefly, the point that we tried to make in our written statement, and I'll turn it quickly over to Bob, was we're going through a lot of gymnastics to try and rope in executive compensation, and in particular with clawbacks, multi-year payouts, payouts in stock. Those may or may not be relevant to the underlying issues of company management, and we certainly have encouraged say on pay and other investor guidance. But they all strike me at one level as highlighting the fact that we don't trust the earnings that we are reporting because we haven't been able to build in an effective assessment of tail risk when we make a judgment about complicated financial instruments in many regards. And that to the extent that we can improve some of our quality of earnings assessments so that we have greater confidence that we're not going to get these surprises because we haven't valued the instruments correctly in the first place, I think it would help assess and remediate some of the issues that we've identified in terms of trying to deal with the fact that right now we think it's such a soft number, we don't know whether 2 years, 4 years, 6 years from now, the instrument, as it goes through its earning life cycle, is just going to explode on us.
Steve, from my perspective, just taking compensation discussion analysis, there's three major components. There's the measurement of the compensation, which frankly has some complicated formulas involved in it, whether it's the current value of a pension right or the value of a secure or of equity type compensation. Secondly, there's the philosophy discussion, and I guess thirdly, it's how it affects the business of the issuer, whether or not it's really driving the behaviors that the board thinks it should be driving. But that's, to me, that's just one aspect of a company's disclosure of their story that could be subject to audit that currently isn't. I try to put myself in the shoes of the board and looking for the auditor to help validate what the board does on behalf of the shareholder so that the shareholder gets the benefit of an independent look. The board gets the benefit of an auditor's independent look. And it's across the board. It's across the entire story of the enterprise, not just the balance sheet.
But what is the auditor looking for in terms of executive compensation?
Well, actually, in the where I sit on the audit committee of a public company, we ask the internal auditor to check all the calcs, for one thing. We ask the comp committee to make sure that the philosophy is well articulated. And then the audit committee itself takes on the, I guess, the task of assessing whether or not it's being deployed in a way that promotes what the philosophy is intended to promote: right behaviors, strategic objectives, and it does so effectively. So it's a combination of risk assessment, pure calculating, you know, pure rechecking calcs, and then and then making sure that it's doing what it ought to do.
Tony and Gus.
Tony Sunday. Steve, I was going to say that in response to your question to Bob, one of the things that I have found in my analysis of compensation is that when the compensation exceeds for a particular company, top management exceeds their peers and so on, I find that it's worth taking a look at their financial reporting choices. And I find problems and issues in that. One of my classic examples is one of the biggest companies in this country. They were reporting the gain on sale of patents as a reduction of their SG&A. And it was partly because their CEO's compensation was tied to a reduction in SG&A expenses. So these are the kinds of things you can find, these core relationships, when you look for. And I think that's one of the things that I would ask, you know, when an auditor, it's good for them to check the calculations, but I can actually check most calculations on my own without any help from anybody.
Gus and then Bonnie.
Thank you, Steve. This is Gus Slaughter. We deal directly with the companies that we own, and we talk with them on a constant basis. We send them a letter and tell them exactly what we expect them to do with regard to executive compensation. We want to know what incentives they've aligned and whether or not those incentives are aligned with best value for us. We let them know that if we don't like their compensation incentives, we'll vote against all of the members of the comp committee. We want to know the magnitude of the compensation. Certainly, you talk about a CEO that supposedly added $500 million worth of value to a company and therefore is deserving of $100 million. Quite frankly, we find it a little difficult that somebody else could not have added at least $450 million, so maybe $50 million would have been just fine. There is a maximum level where we think compensation just gets to be too high. Nevertheless, we're not supporters of say-on-pay because, quite honestly, we think a lot of it's one of those questions that it's almost like asking, have you stopped beating your spouse? And you almost can't answer it without with some degree of objectivity. That most people are going to say, no, I don't like compensation. Well, you know, it's supposedly non-binding, at least at this point in time. I don't know if it is at some point in time, but I think a lot of people just aren't able to say whether or not pay levels are appropriate and yet have the ability to vote on it. So I must say that we're not in favor of say on pay. Steve, you asked what is the auditor's responsibility for this. Is this just information that's required in the financial statements? I think one thing the auditor could divulge is the incentive. So are the incentives really truly aligned with the investor? And a comment on that from the auditor, I think, would be helpful to individual investors.
Bonnie?
Bonnie Hill. There are a couple of things as it relates to compensation. One is there's a tendency to look at just the upper level of compensation when you're looking at risk. And there are levels of compensation throughout the organization, places and positions where there could be a real risk of fraud. And we would look for the auditors to help identify those and, as a matter of fact, put those down as questions for them when they go through the organization. Do you see any areas in which a particular employee or group of employees have the ability to put the company at risk, and they may not be the highest paid. So that becomes important. In terms of, I'm with Gus on the say on pay part, one, because the compensation committee spent countless hours sorting through compensation, and it is not very easy, as you know, when you look at the proxies and you try to decipher all of the various charts. I am in favor of shareholders having a conversation with the compensation committee or with the company prior to having to make that kind of vote. And so, you know, if they've been following it and the year before they saw something they didn't like, I would encourage that they would have that discussion with the company, because straight up or down vote does absolutely nothing. And I've had some shareholder groups to say, well, it gives us an opportunity to have dialogue with the company. Well, you have access to the company and you should have that dialogue in advance, because the shareholders own the company and the board reports to the shareholders for the most part. And so in that regard, I would much rather see a dialogue on compensation prior to a straight up or down vote.
Ann?
Ann Simpson, CalPERS. I'm concerned about us overstretching the auditor by suggesting that they start looking at compensation. You know, the board has a job here. So just harken back to what said earlier, that we need to look at this whole series of checks and balances and roles and relationships in its totality. So this is why it matters that we have majority voting, so that you can vote no, not just I withhold on compensation committee members. That really matters. Proxy access really matters. And staggered boards are a problem. And because of those barriers to the board being accountable, we're hunting around for these ways, like say on pay, invented in the UK, is a bit of a feather duster to tickle public opinion with. It doesn't actually get to the heart of the problem. And I think in terms of the message, there's very few circumstances where you need very detailed individual discussions. The big picture stuff is clear. You need money at risk. You need performance measures which fit with the strategy and the life cycle of the industry, and just benchmarking yourself to what everyone else is doing is often a problem, because they're all late woebegone, they're all above average chief executives, and before you know it, you've got sectors where it's out of control. I really agree with what Bonnie said, though, for the auditor's role, which is that it's about tying it into risk management and their appraisal and responsibilities in that department. But let's not try and load the auditor up with everything. That's what the board's there to do.
Mike. This is Mike Head, and I think I mirror a lot. I think table stakes is making sure the disclosures in the proxy are accurate and reliable, and that's a combination of internal auditors and external auditing. From an audit role point of view, I think there are some venues that, other than what's been mentioned that I've heard, is, and I think, Tony, you were starting to get at it, is use of company assets and T&E reimbursement and other things that are benefits that executive officers, use of corporate planes, the straight-up proxy compensation and what you can tie to contracts. I think the corporate governance and holding the board accountable and the comp committee is the right way to go, and the auditor is just making sure that process is in place and the risk management governance. But where I think the value of the audit efforts is in these the Tyco stuff, the misuse and not in accordance with the policies that the company and the board have set. So the auditors are in a better position to say, are they what they're seeing in the financial statements aligned with corporate policies that the governance structure has approved, and that structure is adequate, versus trying to make due decisions for the board and the board comp committee. And I think there's going to be more opportunities for misuse of classification and use of company assets than the governance structure itself.
Turning to the two remaining issues just very, very quickly. On inspections, Barbara Roper, you indicated that the PCOB should develop a robust and formalized system for analyzing inspection findings and using that analysis to inform other board activities. And then, Bonnie, you mentioned that as well, and that you thought we should do a better job focusing our inspections on significant issues and risks. I think, Mike, we've already touched on your point with respect to inspection, but I was wondering whether or not Barbara, you or Bonnie want to say anything on that issue. Barbara, do you want to?
I mean, I'll just say briefly, we talked about this at the last standing advisory group meeting. You know, it's my understanding that the board is working on ways to use the information from inspections effectively to inform the standard setting process. It's something that we've talked about as an issue within SAG for a number of years, that the information comes out of inspections has the potential to really be meaningful in terms of helping to identify problem areas and areas where there may be changes that are needed to the standards, the audit standards. I think it flows together well with the notion of a fraud center, which is, you know, something I very strongly support, that the PCAOB just should think about how to formalize that process, make sure there's a clear formal process for how the information that comes out of those procedures then informs the standard setting process and the other things that the board does.
And then, Kelvin, you mentioned, and this probably is a conversation which is so large that we might want to save it for another time, but in a snippet you mentioned investor education and the expectation gap. Do you want to briefly comment on your concerns?
Sure.
There?
Sure. It's Kelvin Blake. I don't know to what extent the PCAOB currently reaches out to investors, but I did suggest that perhaps they can start an investor education program where they're making investors aware of the audit process, both the benefits and the limitations of the audit process, and perhaps in an effort to narrow the expectation gap that now exists. Also recommended perhaps encouraging senior-level members of the accounting profession to meet more often with investor groups so that the investor groups can explain, you know, what their expectations are from the audit process and help to improve audit transparency, what effects investors think the new accounting standards may have on the their decisions, and any other relevant issues.
Well, before concluding, I'd like to point out that yesterday the board announced that the PCAOB is seeking nominations for a standing advisory group, and a copy of our press release is in your packet. And as I think most of you know, this standing advisory group is an integral part of the PCAOB standard setting process. And it would be extremely helpful if members of this group could help identify potential candidates by either nominating them yourselves or asking the candidates to submit a self-nomination form, which can be found on our website. And I think that, or you ought to feel free to contact Marty Bauman directly with respect to that. In conclusion, because it's very close to 5, I don't want to give Dan the last remarks and the other board members if they care to make any. In terms of, I think what we'll do in terms of follow-up is we'll prepare a generic summary of today's meeting, which we'll distribute to all the group members. I think we'll get back to each of the panels for any possible follow-up issues prior to our next meeting. I think it's been an extremely productive day, and on all the panels there have been recommendations. And I'm not sure how realistic or feasible it will be, but I talked to a couple of folk during the break, and there may be follow-up items that which we will want to discuss with each panel, and then get a work product out of you if it makes sense. So we will summarize. We'll get back in touch. I want to thank very much all of you for your participation. I want to particularly thank Joanne Heineman, who's put this together, both substantively and administratively. Joanne, you did a terrific job. I want to thank Jennifer Stokes and Bob. You're out of sight, out of mind, but you've been extremely helpful, and we're totally depending upon you to continue to be helpful. So thank you very much, and we appreciate very much all of your participation. I don't know whether any of the board members want to make final comments.
I'll just join you in saying thank you to everybody for your participation. You've certainly given us a lot to think about, and I look forward to the next meeting of this group.